The Constitution of the United States. A set of rules to govern the government. Ignored and trampled by both Democrats and Republicans for far too long. So, what do we do about it?
We don't need no stinking permission to exercise our rights.
From the 10th Amendment Center, around the nation and into your ears, welcome to TRX.
There's a growing movement of people around the country.
Ground zero for the 10th Amendment movement.
The answer to 1984 is...
The 10th Amendment Center.
Tell us, what is it?
It's about sticking to the Constitution. And now, the host of TRX, Michael Bolden.
This is Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and you are listening to TRX 10th Radio. We are live every single Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, at radio.10thamendmentcenter.com. Rather than our normal format where we have a couple of guests and a couple of different segments and talk about a bunch of different topics, we have a very special more of a longer event on one specific topic that really needs a lot of coverage and a lot of understanding constitutionally. A couple of years ago here at the 10th Amendment Center, we started a very small, every couple of weeks podcast where we did interviews with a number of people, including Sheriff Mack and Gary Marbit, who we heard here, both of whom we heard here on the show in the last few weeks, and Rob Nadelson, who is one of the nation's leading constitutional scholars. He also wrote the book that the 10th Amendment Center published. We just updated it to a second edition, The Original Constitution. And, of course, I got to plug it. If you have not gotten the book yet, you'll want to go to 10thamendmentcenter.com and look right near the top in the middle. There's a button that looks like a book. It says The Original Constitution. Just click that, and you'll get all the info on the book. And you can order through us or Amazon or a bunch of other online places, I'm sure. But anyways, we did a number of interviews back a couple of years ago. And one of them that I think was the most important one we did was on the General Welfare Clause. This is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 of the Constitution. And the federal government today and the pundits and the politicians alike, they basically claim all their expansions of power are okay under the General Welfare Clause, also necessary and proper, and the Commerce Clause. But one of the top places they go is the General Welfare Clause. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about what that clause really means and how it's really supposed to function constitutionally. And 2 years ago now, I was able to do a full one-hour interview with Rob Nadelson, to get an in-depth look not only at how that clause is supposed to be applied, but how it's been twisted, and some more important goodies. So what I wanted to do tonight was share with you, and we'll do it in segments. We'll have our usual breaks at 4 after and 20 after and throughout the show. But I wanted to present this important discussion on the General Welfare Clause. And I want to thank John Michaels for in the studio for getting this interview set up to broadcast tonight and broken up into the segments and in a nice, easy-to-digest way. And I hope you get as much out of it listening to it tonight as I did when I had the honor of chatting with Rob a couple of years ago. And please share this with your friends as widely as possible. Again, thanks for tuning in, and let's get the ball rolling, and we'll hear what Rob has to say about the General Welfare Clause.
TRX, you're helping you to unlearn what they told you at government school. For more information on topics being discussed on today's show, visit us at radio.10thamendmentcenter.com. That's radio.10thamendmentcenter.com. Membership has its privileges. Become a card-carrying 110% Tenther with your paid membership to 10thamendmentcenter.com for more of the inside scoop than anywhere else. You have been listening to TRX on the 10th Amendment Center Radio Network.
Joining us today is Rob Nadelson, professor of law at the University of Montana and a recognized national expert on the framing and adoption of the U.S. Constitution. Rob, it's an honor having you here with us. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's an honor to be here, Michael.
Rob, I think two of the most misunderstood and probably, I would say, misused words in the Constitution are general and welfare. What I'm hoping you can do today is give us at least a brief lesson on their proper meaning and role. And I guess the best way to start that is, where do we find those words in the Constitution, and what's the introductory definition of what they mean where we see them in the Constitution?
Well, there are two places where you can find them. One is in the preamble, which is a statement of intent, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. And the other is in the list of the primary list of powers of Congress. That's in Article 1, Section 8, and it's actually in the first clause of that section. What general welfare was a very common phrase in the founding. If you read literature, political literature at the time, it shows up a lot. So we do have a pretty good idea what it means. It means the welfare of the society as a whole, as opposed to the welfare of a particular region or the welfare of particular special interest groups. It's also analogous or similar to the idea that when a trustee works for several different people in the trust, several different beneficiaries, he's got to treat them all fairly and act for the general welfare of the trust or the general welfare of the enterprise, and not just for a few of the folks that he works for.
Now, you mentioned that we find it in the preamble. How do the words and that original meaning of those words, how does that apply to the preamble of the Constitution?
Well, it's important to understand what a preamble is. A preamble is a statement of intent, and sometimes it's a statement that provides background facts, and it gets put at the beginning of a document. That's why it's called preamble, from the Latin word for to walk before. We still use preambles to a very great extent today in legal documents. If you see a legal document with the whereas clauses at the beginning, that's a preamble. And what that does is, as I said, it tells the intent of the people who made the document, and also sometimes it sets forth background facts. However, the wording in the preamble actually doesn't have any legal force. So I think that not too long ago I saw a claim that because the preamble says that one of the purposes of the Constitution is to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, that therefore Congress could do anything for the general welfare. That's not right. The preamble doesn't give any power. It's a mere statement that tends to shed the light on the rest of the document when you're interpreting it.
Now, moving forward to the general welfare clause in Article 1, Section 8, I often hear people say, well, the word welfare means so many things that we know it means today, such as providing for health care or providing for retirement funds. What do you have to say in response to that point of view?
Well, it's actually almost funny. That's obviously not the way it is used in the document. And you're right, it's a very common misconception. I saw a clip recently from MSNBC in which the commentator claimed that the health care plan proposed by President Obama, or at least favored by him, could be justified under the General Welfare Clause. And there's no real foundation for that in the meaning of the Constitution at all. The place where the language appears is in the taxing clause, and it might be important to read just a quick excerpt from it. It says that the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. So it's a grant of the power to Congress to tax. It wasn't designed to give Congress the power to do anything but tax. The reason the language, the common defense and general welfare of the United States is in there, the founders explained to us, is to signal that any money that is raised by the taxing has to be used for general welfare purposes. It can't be used, let's say, to benefit a particular section or to benefit a special interest. So what it is a limitation on the taxing power. It actually doesn't authorize the federal government to do anything.
Now, when you say the founders explained what this means, was there a complete concurrence between leading founders? What was potential different understandings of the role of the General Welfare Clause under the Constitution?
Well, that's a great question. Early on, some of the opponents of the Constitution, you know, they were looking around for reasons to oppose the document, and they claimed that the General Welfare Clause would give Congress the power to do anything it wanted to for the general welfare, something like the claim that is made today by people who aren't too clever about constitutional issues. And in response to that, the Federalists, those who advocated the Constitution, very clearly pointed out that the purpose of the General Welfare Clause was as a limit on the tax power. And that was pretty much all that it was designed to do, to make clear that any money that was raised could only be used for general welfare purposes and not for partial purposes. I should say also that when you look at the clause, you'll see immediately after it, the Constitution goes in and starts listing other powers that Congress has. If Congress could do anything for the general welfare, then there would be no need to list all those other powers. And probably about a third of the Constitution would simply be meaningless verbiage. There is one founder, however, who is sometimes cited for a wider interpretation of this clause, only one founder, and that is Alexander Hamilton. And if you like, Michael, we can talk a little bit about him, because there's an interesting story behind that.
I'd love to hear.
Okay. Well, Alexander Hamilton was what we would call today a political extremist. He did not share the views that most of the other founders shared regarding government. He was at the Constitutional Convention. He stood up and he said, look, this is what I want. I want a president for life. I want a Senate for life. I want an assembly elected for 3-year terms, and I want the Congress to be able to do anything it wants, anything. Some people even thought he wanted to abolish the states, although I'm not clear that's true. When the other delegates refused to join with him, he went home. And he stayed away for much of the convention because the Constitution as it was shaping up was completely contrary to his views. In fact, he actually wrote a letter at one point in which he said, well, I'm going to support the document because it's better than nothing. But he said, it's impossible to be further from my views than this Constitution is. Many people believe that Hamilton, or at least some people believe that Hamilton, was probably a closet monarchist. He really wanted a king or a government like they had in Britain. Anyway, when he did figure, as I said, the Constitution was better than nothing, and so he helped to write the Federalist Papers, and he helped to get the Constitution passed. And when he did that, he did what the other advocates of the Constitution did, and then he made very clear that this was going to be a government of strictly limited powers, that it would not be able to do anything for the general welfare. However, we have a memo from Hamilton that is written about the time the Constitution was finished, in which he essentially says to himself that once we get this thing passed, the president will be George Washington, and then we can do anything we want, and we can grind the states into the dust. And then once he became Treasury Secretary, he started to do that. And one of the things he came up with was this kind of cockamamie theory that nobody else signed on to, which was that the General Welfare Clause actually gave to Congress the power to spend money for anything it wanted for the general welfare, not to do other things, not to regulate, but to spend money for anything it deemed appropriate for the general welfare. Well, as I said, the other founders kind of rolled their eyes. James Madison said if Hamilton's view were accepted, we should take the whole Constitution, just throw it in the flames. And so nobody paid much attention to Hamilton until 1936, the Supreme Court was under extreme political pressure during the New Deal. And in the course of an opinion, they inadvisedly subscribed or signed on to Hamilton's view. Now, they didn't actually apply it to the case, but the following year they did. And ever since that time, that one way out of the mainstream view by one founder, Hamilton, has been used by Congress and has been used by the Supreme Court to turn the General Welfare Clause from a limit on the tax power into a broad spending power where Congress can spend on almost anything it wants.
So if you were to compare the original meaning, the original understanding of the General Welfare Clause with how it's applied today, how would you relate those two?
Well, as I said, it's like one. How it's applied today is like standing it on its head. The original purpose of the clause was to say, look, Congress can spend money only under its enumerated powers. But even when it spends money under its enumerated powers, it still has to act for the general welfare. So, for example, Congress has the power to build post offices. But the General Welfare Clause is supposed to prevent Congress from taxing to use money to build post offices only in the Northeast. In other words, to prevent that kind of special interest approach. And the courts, as far as I can tell, were supposed to be able to strike down legislation that violated the general welfare rule. So it was a limit on the tax power. What it has become is the source or the justification for huge boondoggles passed by Congress for all kinds of regional and special interest purposes. Let me just give you a sense of how far we are from the founding era with a little story here. You may recall that in 2005 we had Hurricane Katrina, and the Bush administration got enormous criticism from the press, saying that the Bush administration should have been in there early on and helping out the victims of the New Orleans disaster. They overlooked the fact that taking care of natural disasters is mostly a state responsibility, and criticized the Bush administration for not moving fast enough for doing this. Well, that would have been inappropriate as far as the founders were concerned. And here's an example. In 1796, just a few years after the Constitution was adopted, there was a severe fire in Savannah, Georgia. It essentially destroyed much of the city. And representatives from Georgia came to Congress and said, could you give us a federal bailout? Would you give us congressional money in order to rebuild Savannah? And the response they got was, well, that would be a violation of the General Welfare Clause. We can't just hand over money to one city. The response of the representatives from Georgia and Savannah was, hey, look, this isn't, you know, Podunk, South Carolina. This is Savannah, Georgia. This is a major port. And the national welfare is tied up with Savannah, Georgia. So we think you can justify giving federal money to us to help us rebuild our city. And the answer that Congress gave was no. By a 2-to-1 vote, they turned down the application. It was simply not in the founders' purview that federal money, which is supposed to be used for national purposes, would be handed over to a special interest or to a local interest.
But the founders obviously understood that times change, and that's generally the response. And back then, of course, things weren't as interdependent, especially economically, in a port like Savannah compared to New Orleans. Isn't that right?
Well, actually, the founders recognized that things were very interdependent, and they talked about that a great deal. In other words, they recognized that commerce, for example, affected manufacturing, and that manufacturing affected agriculture, and that even things like religion affected how a country was operated. So they understood the interdependence of all these factors, but they made the decision that in order to prevent centralized power, in order to prevent tyranny, that they would divide up the power between the federal government and the states. And they would accept the occasional inconvenience. If a problem crossed state boundaries, well, then Congress could act to take care of it if it was within Congress's enumerated powers. If it didn't, if it was outside of Congress's enumerated powers, the affected states could still get together and form a compact, and states do that today with the consent of Congress. Or the Constitution could be amended. I mean, the amendment process was a way of dealing with changed conditions. But the central vision of the founders, which is that people operating in government have a public trust and they have an obligation to treat people impartially and fairly, that vision is in the General Welfare Clause. And I think that we would be well advised to look at that vision. If you like the spending habits of Congress today, if you like the way that Congress has become a big auction for special interests, if you like the fact that Congress has only balanced its budget six times, I think, in the last 50 years, if that's what you like, well, then you can say that the founders' vision of the General Welfare Clause was a bad one. But I think most people realize there is something profoundly wrong with the way Congress is spending money. And one of the reasons for that is simply because the courts and Congress and the president have refused to respect the General Welfare Clause as it was supposed to be applied.
This is 10th Hour Radio, and we'll be back with more of me, Michael Bolden, and Rob Nadelson and the Constitution's General Welfare Clause in just a couple of minutes after these important messages.
You have been listening to TRX on the 10th Amendment Center Radio Network.
Federal politicians got you down? On October 22nd, 2011, you can get on the road to recovery at Nullify Now Jacksonville. There, you'll learn the how, why, and what of nullification, Jefferson's remedy to unconstitutional actions by the federal government. The states can and must stop D.C. because it'll never fix itself. Join Jack Hunter, the Southern Avenger, Stuart Rhodes of Oath Keepers, and me, Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center, plus a few others, at Nullify Now in Jacksonville, Florida, on October 22nd. For tickets and more information, visit nullifynow.com/Jacksonville or call 888-71-TICKETS.
Do you feel chained down by taxation and inflation? Many of us do, but you can free yourself and your wealth from the devastating effects of taxation and inflation while increasing the control, use, and liquidity of your money. How? By implementing the infinite banking concept and learning how to become your own banker. Visit www.bankingwithlife.com. At its core, the idea is to get banking out of the control of the Federal Reserve and put it squarely at the you and me level. Not only is James Nethery an infinite banking concept educator, coach, and trainer, he is also a regular supporter of the 10th Amendment Center. Visit www.bankingwithlife.com for more information today.
$500 million Americans lose their jobs.
And the government running all of your companies.
Do you want the Democratic plan or do you want the Republican plan? The Republicans want you to die quickly.
Federal politicians got you down? You can get on the road to recovery on October 22nd, 2011 at Nullify Now Jacksonville. There, you'll learn the how, why, and what of nullification. Jefferson's remedy to unconstitutional actions by the federal government. The states can and must stop D.C. because it'll never fix itself. Join Jack Hunter, the Southern Avenger, Stuart Rhodes of Oath Keepers, and me, Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center, plus a few others. Nullify Now in Jacksonville, Florida, October 22nd. For tickets and more information, visit nullifynow.com/Jacksonville or call 888-71-TICKETS.
Fight the power. You have been listening to TRX on the 10th Amendment Center Radio Network.
We are back here on TRX 10th Radio, which we are every single Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, at radio.10thamendmentcenter.com. We've been listening to a previous recording that I did a couple of years ago with Rob Nadelson on the general welfare clause that I thought was extremely important and important enough to share with you again here tonight on 10th Hour Radio, or today, or whenever you actually are listening, if you're tuning into the archives. But let's get right back into that. Thanks for staying in through the break, and let's get back into that interview that I had with Rob, and I'm hoping you'll get some great information out of this segment as well.
TRX. It's interesting that you mentioned Hamilton's position on the General Welfare Clause and how it really didn't come into being until the 1930s. And I've often heard people who support the limiting nature of that clause refer to the current use of it as even outside the scope of what Hamilton ever even dreamed of. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, I really don't know. I don't know what Hamilton would think about the current government. There's no question he favored a federal government that could do pretty much anything. But it's very possible if he looked at what it has become, even he would shrink in horror. We really don't know. You know, Michael, there's a point that I'd like to make about interpreting the Constitution generally when people, for folks who are interested in this subject. Some of the founders are actually a little bit more reliable than others on the interpretation of the Constitution. And I think that mistakes are often made by relying too much on Hamilton, who, as I said, was really, in the language of today, kind of a political extremist, relying on his views. And on the opposite side, there are also mistakes in relying upon Thomas Jefferson's views. Hamilton was on one far end of the spectrum, and Jefferson was on the other far end of the spectrum, and they really were really pretty out of touch as far as what most of the founders were trying to do in the course of the Constitution. In addition, Jefferson wasn't even around. I mean, Jefferson was in France at the time, and Hamilton, as I mentioned a minute ago, was not being entirely honest when he issued his interpretations for the Constitution. So If you're interested in what founders said about the Constitution, what you want to do is you want to look at people who are more in the mainstream than either Jefferson or Hamilton. They would include people like John Dickinson, James Madison, Edmund Randolph, James Wilson. These are much more reliable expositors of what the Constitution meant than either Jefferson or Hamilton.
Were there any major discussions of the General Welfare Clause in the ratifying conventions at all?
There was in the ratifying conventions, and there was also in the literature, that is to say, in the pamphlets and the newspaper articles and the speeches of the day. And there were a number of people who made comments and made clear that this was a device to limit government, not to expand government. George Nicholas, for example, was one of the leading spokesmen for the Constitution in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, explained that. So he would be one example. Another example would be Noah Webster. This is the same Webster who later on went ahead and, you know, wrote the dictionary. Noah Webster was a young man who was very much for the Constitution. He wrote a very influential pamphlet, and he pointed out in it that the General Welfare Clause is designed to limit congressional powers and that they could not pass legislation that went outside it. So those are just two examples. There were others as well.
Now, you mentioned some anti-federalist opposition. Some would call it fear-mongering, maybe at the time that this clause was going to be twisted and turned. But if you look over the course of history, some would say that possibly the anti-federalists were correct in how the General Welfare Clause and possibly many other parts of the Constitution were going to be used. What were some of the most prominent voices of opposition or concern in regards to this?
You know, that's a reaction, Michael, that my students often have. I teach a course on the founding at the University of Montana, and they'll look and they'll read and they'll say, hey, you know, well, the anti-federalists were right. They predicted this big federal leviathan, and that's what we've got. But actually, they were right only in the very, very long term. I mean, the Constitution remained, and limits on Congress remained pretty strong for about 150 years. In fact, some would argue that maybe the Constitution created a federal government that wasn't quite strong enough because, of course, it almost got torn apart by the Civil War. So it's only in the very, very long range that you would say that the Anti-Federalists might have been right. As to who they were, they were a mixed group. Many of them were among the most respected political figures in America. A good example was George Mason. George Mason had attended the convention. He was a delegate from Virginia. He had participated actively in the framing of the Constitution, but he wanted a Bill of Rights added to the Constitution. He had a few other requests, too, but his big thing was he wanted a Bill of Rights, and he was a guy who should have known. I mean, he had actually been the author of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. And so at the very end, he said, look, unless you put a Bill of Rights on here, I'm not going to sign it. And he did not sign it because they didn't have a Bill of Rights at that time. And he went into opposition. But one of the reasons we do have a Bill of Rights is because of the courage that George Mason showed in bucking the majority at the convention and insisting upon one. Another example is a man named Elbridge Gerry. Elbridge Gerry later became Vice President of the United States. He became Governor of Massachusetts. So he's a very respected figure. But he was concerned, again, that the Constitution didn't have a Bill of Rights. He wanted language to reinforce what the Federalists said about the General Welfare Clause and what they said about the Necessary and Proper Clause, which was also a clause that was a matter of some concern. So those were two leading Anti-Federalist voices. One more I should mention, Richard Henry Lee. Richard Henry Lee was a congressman. He had served in Congress from Virginia, and he was the fellow who actually introduced the motion for independence that led directly to the Declaration of Independence. So we're talking about somebody who was enormously influential and respected. He looked at the Constitution and said we needed a Bill of Rights. We needed to reinforce the limits on the Constitution. And he wrote a series of essays under the name of The Federal Farmer that are still cited from time to time by the United States Supreme Court. So those are three examples of Anti-Federalists. And they tended not to take the sort of extreme position. Those respected folks tended not to argue that the General Welfare Clause really gave Congress the right to do anything. The people who made those claims were people who were somewhat more sloppy with the truth.
You talk about the Constitution as actually having limits for maybe the first 150 years. And in a previous discussion, we talked about a lot that happened in the New Deal era. When you mentioned that 1936, there was a court case that started the trend of turning the General Welfare Clause on its head, what was that case, and what was the one in the following year that's been, was it used as precedent a little bit more often?
Right. The case that was decided in 1936 was United States versus Butler. And this was a case that involved the constitutionality of a New Deal program to give farm subsidies to farmers. The government argued in that case that the subsidies were constitutional because the federal government could spend money on anything that it thought was for the general welfare. The Supreme Court issued a very strange opinion for what apparently were reasons of inside political pool. I'm not sure if they're relevant right now, but what the Supreme Court said was, we agree with Alexander Hamilton that the federal government may spend money on pretty much anything. However, in this case, the regulation of agriculture invades the rights of the states under the 10th Amendment. And so they struck down the program. Now, the decision makes absolutely no sense, because if Congress has the power under Article 1, Section 8 to spend money on practically anything, then there's no 10th Amendment problem, because what the 10th Amendment says is that if Congress doesn't have the power, it's reserved to the states or to the people. So it's kind of a nutty decision. The following year, there was a case called Halvering against Davis. There were actually two cases that came up around that same time. And they dealt with the issue of the constitutionality of the Social Security system. And the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of Social Security, obviously a big spending program, simply citing the language from Butler from the previous year, where the court had said, we agree with Hamilton, the federal government can spend money on almost anything. So that's, as in so many other areas of the Constitution, it was during those New Deal years that the traditional understanding was altered so radically.
I think most people recognize that in times of emergency, there's going to be a greater opportunity or a greater willingness to allow government to take more powers, to exercise more powers. But what's happened since that time? Has there been any cases that's addressed this issue? Have they all ruled on the same type of precedent? Has the clause been expanded even further?
Well, your point about emergency is really important, because some of the cases that came out of the late 1930s and 1940s have been discredited. Probably the most famous example, or at least the one I can think of right off the bat, is Korematsu versus United States, in which the Roosevelt administration ordered tens of thousands of Japanese-American citizens, I mean, American citizens of Japanese ancestry, to be herded into concentration camps without a writ of habeas corpus, without any proof of guilt of anything. This is a horrendous decision, and actually is kind of an insight into how the Roosevelt administration operated, frankly. Well, that case has been thoroughly discredited, and I don't think that something like that could easily happen again today. However, the other cases that dealt with the emergency economic conditions have never been overruled, and they have continued to be used as precedent or perhaps pretexts for the construction of a government that is far beyond all of its constitutional bounds. To answer your question specifically, Michael, there has never, ever been a Supreme Court case in which the Supreme Court said, hey, look, this program is too much of a special interest program, or it's too much of a narrow interest program, and therefore it violates the general welfare clause. Essentially, the court has said, we abdicate in this area. Congress can do as it likes.
What are some of the biggest programs? You mentioned Social Security. What are the other great government programs that have been enacted, in essence, under this type of interpretation of the general welfare clause?
Well, anything that involves the expenditure of a large amount of money. Now, we're not talking about regulatory programs. For example, let's say the Endangered Species Act, for example, that's a regulatory program. So I'm not talking about that kind of program. But those that involve expenditures of large amount of money, Medicaid, Medicare, programs for the or allegedly for the relief of the poor, spending programs on various little items of pork around the country. A great example is that University of Montana recently built a new building for its law school, largely courtesy of federal taxpayers. It's hard to argue. I mean, I work at the University of Montana, and that's really great, but it's hard to argue that taxpayers in Pennsylvania or Maryland somehow benefit from a new building for the training of lawyers in Montana. But that's the kind of expenditure that's justified under the general welfare clause.
You are listening to Tenther Radio, and we'll continue listening to this important discussion about the general welfare clause with constitutional scholar and national expert on the Constitution, Rob Nadelson, in just a couple of minutes. So please listen to these important messages, and we'll be right back.
You have been listening to TRX on the 10th Amendment Center Radio Network. Transcend the perpetual ping-pong battle between the Democrats and the Republicans today. The transpartisan agenda of the 10th Amendment Center says we don't care who you voted for as long as you stand with us against big government. Join the movement today at 10thAmendmentCenter.com. That's 10thAmendmentCenter.com. Stay up to date on all of the issues that affect your liberties at 10thAmendmentCenter.com or join us on YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter.
Do you have a message, a business, a group, a foundation, an idea, or anything else that you want to get in the ears of the Tenther Movement? Contact us today about advertising opportunities right here on TRX Tenther Radio. Send an email to radio@10thAmendmentCenter.com.
Are you growing something in your backyard forbidden by the feds? Is fear of an armed federal crackdown deterring you from raw milk? Time to tell Washington, D.C., no. Time to demand that your legislators introduce the Intrastate Commerce Act. Get the bill now by going to 10thAmendmentCenter.com/legislation. That's 10thAmendmentCenter.com/legislation. Is that the TSA in your pocket? Or are you just happy to be listening to TRX?
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to?
Thanks for staying tuned through the break. This is Michael Bolden. We are here at TRX 10ther Radio again. That's radio.10thAmendmentCenter.com for those of you listening on the archives. And let's get back to this important interview that I had with Rob Nadelson a while back and get some more constitutional goodies on the General Welfare Clause.
TRX.
If now what people come back and say, well, you know, you're against Medicare, you're against Medicaid, you want people to starve on the streets, you want old people to die of health care. Of course not. One of the things that has happened is that the federal government is now, through its spending under the General Welfare Clause, absorbing such a huge portion of the state economy that the states are unable to run effective social programs of their own at the level that, you know, that many people believe would be necessary. So it's not just that the federal government has exceeded its constitutional responsibility. It has grabbed so much of the economy, I think it's going well over 20% of the economy this year, and crowded out the ability of state and local governments to meet the problems that state and local governments should meet.
Would this also include things like the like federal highway funding, for example?
No. Under Article 1, Section 8, Congress is empowered to build post roads. Now, most people think that post roads mean roads for the carrying of mail. And there is a meaning of post roads that means that. But the dominant meaning in the 18th century of a post road is what we would call an interstate highway. It was a highway that went from town to town, meant for express travel, fast travel, and along the way it had posts, that is to say, you know, we would call them rest stops or travel stops, where people could get fuel for their horses or a hotel room or whatever. So the interstate highway system, the major highway system, I think is authorized under the power of Congress to establish post roads.
The question that I'm often asked when presenting an originalist viewpoint or original understanding of any part of the Constitution, any clause, is, well, the Supreme Court is the one that's supposed to give us an explanation. They're the ones that determine what's right and what's wrong, and we've got decades of precedent. So why should we care what it meant 200 years ago?
Well, let me say that the court, especially the current court, is actually very respectful to original understanding. Many of the judges feel bound by a lot of bad precedents that they have to deal with. But when you compare this court with, say, the court of 30 years ago, it seemed to me rarely cared about the original understanding. This court is much more respectful of it. We saw that in two cases decided last year. The Beaumediene case, which dealt with habeas corpus, in which the court analyzed 18th century habeas corpus very carefully to see what the founders would have intended. And then we also saw that in the Heller case that upheld the federal right to keep and bear arms, both the dissent and the majority opinions in both of those cases were very respectful of original understanding. So I think the court in that respect has been moving back in the right direction. But you know, Michael, the founders gave us a Republican form of government. And an important component to a Republican form of government is the rule of law. The idea that there are certain written rules that are clear for everybody, and that as long as we follow them, we won't get into trouble. And that those rules are limited to certain aspects of life, leaving most aspects of life for us so that we are free to make our own decisions. If the court disregards original understanding, if the court invades that part of our lives that is supposed to be protected by the Constitution, that breaks down the rule of law. It makes us all much less free, and it increases, I believe, social discord. It creates a situation like we have in Congress, where Congress is congenitally unable to balance its budget. It results in the persistent inflation of the currency that we have had. It results ultimately in a poorer life for ourselves and for our children. So, you know, it's not just about some lawyer or law professor saying, oh, gee, wouldn't it be neat if they follow the rules? The failure to follow the rules hurts people, and it hurts them badly. And we see this all around us if we only look.
So if we were actually adhering to an original meaning and understanding of the General Welfare Clause, what most prominent things would be different? How would you talk about hurricane relief in Louisiana, and states should deal with that? How do you see things like that, for example, being handled differently, or Medicare, Medicaid?
Well, in the case of hurricane relief, that would be obviously a principal responsibility of the state. And that's appropriate because, you know, the amount of damage caused by a natural disaster like hurricane relief partly depends upon what the insurance market is like. And it's really the states in our country that have primary responsibility for regulating the insurance market. And so when you have a situation where a lot of people have uninsured damage, then it's really most appropriate that that be handled by the state. Years ago, maybe 50 years ago, people would argue that the states were not wealthy enough to handle that sort of thing. That's no longer true. I mean, every state, virtually every state in the United States, probably even little Vermont, has more wealth than most countries do in the world. So states are able to handle those problems in a way that they couldn't, say, 50 years ago. As for issues like Medicare and Medicaid, well, if the federal government had not intervened in medicine, we wouldn't have a healthcare crisis right now. Like one of the great ironies that we see going on is right now is that some people are calling for the federal government to take over the entire healthcare system, when the reason we have a crisis is because the federal government became involved in the first place. I mean, that's the principal reason. It's not the only reason, but it's overwhelmingly the principal reason for it. If the General Welfare Clause had been respected and we had a system of consumer choice and market control in healthcare instead of trying to run things from Washington, D.C., we would all be a lot better off. When Medicare, I remember I was a kid when Medicare was adopted. I came from a medical family and we followed it very closely. Every single state in the union had its own program for the protection of the elderly or the poor from excessive medical bills. Something like 45 states had adopted a program with the assistance of the federal government called the Kerr-Mills program, which provided aid for those elderly people who couldn't afford medical care. Nevertheless, the federal government said, "Well, no, we're going to take over the whole Megillah," and they created this Medicare program, which has far exceeded, obviously, in cost and intrusiveness and expense what it was supposed to. Now, if the General Welfare Clause had been honored, people would be able to pay their own health bills for the most part. And for those bills that were too high that they couldn't pay for, well, you would have cheap and affordable insurance to cover them. We don't have those things because the general welfare clause has been disregarded.
Did the founders have anything to say or any input or advice on what to do with the indigent? Because some people agree that, okay, well, the government should be following the rules. It should be far more limited. But what do we do about these poor people who can't take care of themselves, even if insurance prices were far lower or cash prices for health care, if we didn't have to deal with third-party payers, were far lower? There's still going to be a portion of the population who can't afford anything. So if we followed strictly the general welfare clause, they'd be left out in the dust. Did the founders have anything to say?
No, the founders... You know, the founders were not real hard-edged libertarians. The founders did believe that both private charities, certainly, and libertarians would agree with that, but also they believed that government had a certain responsibility for the poor and unfortunate. They believed that was best handled at the state and local level, as it was, in fact, handled at the state and local level for nearly 200 years. And the system worked fairly well. The welfare crisis that resulted ultimately in the passage of welfare reform was created only because the federal government got involved in the system. When the Constitution was under consideration, you had these some of the more hysterical anti-federalists saying, oh, you know, the general welfare clause is going to allow Congress to do anything, and they also had other claims about how the federal government would be too strong. And so what the advocates of the Constitution, the Federalists, did is they actually said, look, there are certain things that have to be taken care of by government, but they're going to be taken care of at the state level under our system. That's why we have states. Otherwise, why waste the money on states? So in an article that I wrote a number of years ago on the General Welfare Clause, as well as in some other articles, I actually collect the information or collect the representations that advocates of the Constitution made as to the kinds of things that the states would handle and that the federal government would not. And one of those was care for the poor and unfortunate. If you want me to go through some of the others, I can do that as well. But if I do go through the list, you'll see that the federal government is doing a whole lot of things that the advocates of the Constitution specifically represented the federal government would not be doing.
What's the advantage of keeping these types of things, taking care of the poor and the indigent, on a state level or even on a local level instead of on a national or a federal level? What's the argument in favor of that?
Oh, gee. I mean, there's so many arguments, and I'm not a social scientist, so I'm going to miss some of them. But probably the biggest single argument is the information argument. When welfare is administered on the local level, the people who administer it know who really needs help. They may actually seek out people who really need help because they know, they hear it from the community. They also know who's a malingerer and who doesn't need help. So you can tailor the system much more effectively to the individual recipients. In addition, running it on the local level and state level is generally much cheaper. If you compare the budget of most state governments with the budget of the federal government. There are some states that, of course, are out of control, and perhaps, Michael, yours is one of them. But when you compare how most of the states spend money with the way the federal government spends money, you can see that generally the states and the local governments get a lot more bang for the buck than the federal government does. In addition, price levels differ throughout the country. You know, $100 in Nebraska is going to buy you a somewhat different package of goods and services than $100 in New York City. And so you're able to tailor the program. In my view, it is just absolutely crazy to try to run a program like welfare for the poor and indigent from Washington, D.C. And to a certain extent, the federal government recognizes this because they funnel the money to the states, but they also impose a great number of mandates that limit the flexibility of the states. The only real reason I can see that the federal government has got involved in this area is simply greed for power, because there is no objective reason that I can see why a program like welfare should be run at the federal level rather than the state level. It simply makes no sense.
So the real constitutional argument then is not follow the Constitution, get rid of Social Security. It's decentralize. Is that correct?
It's decentralized. That's right. It's decentralized. Take healthcare, for example. Under the Constitution, if the state of Oregon or the state of Massachusetts wants to establish mandatory health insurance or socialized medicine or whatever, they're free to do that. But they're not free to impose it upon the rest of us. Each person has the ability to choose the state in which he or she wants to live and vote with his or her feet if he or she is not happy with what is going on in that state. When you try to centralize things at the federal level, you create, in some ways, a big prison, because other than to emigrate to a foreign country, people who are dissatisfied with a program have no choice. We see this now going on. There's a lot of publicity regarding people who are stuck in the Canadian healthcare system. And the only way some of them can get the care they need is to go to a foreign country, that is to say, the United States. The more we centralize things at the federal level, the more we as individuals are going to be faced with choices like that. Gee, you know, to get what we need, are we going to have to go to a foreign country? Are we going to have to emigrate? So keeping those sorts of decisions at the local level is great for choice and as well as efficiency.
Yeah, when I go to the grocery store, I see 5 different brands of chicken. It wouldn't make sense to limit it to just one. So I think the same type of
No, Michael, we should have one brand of chicken, and it shouldn't. they all should be grown in hen houses in Washington D.C.
Right.
They all should be standardized, and everybody should eat exactly the same kind of chicken. And you know what? They should all be free.
Absolutely.
You have been listening to TRX on the 10th Amendment Center Radio Network. If our military were given orders to fire on Americans, would they remember their oaths and refuse? The Oath Keepers won't leave that to chance. They are reaching, teaching, and inspiring the current serving military and police to do what they swore to do: defend the Constitution. Visit www.oathkeepers.org to learn more. You don't have to be prior service to join. Freedom-loving citizens can join as associate members. Oath Keepers is now urging veterans to stand up for state sovereignty, with Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes part of the Nullify Now tour. Go to www.oathkeepers.org. Stay up to date on all of the issues that affect your liberties at 10thAmendmentCenter.com, or join us on YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter. TRX.
Thanks again for tuning in. This is TRX, 10ther Radio, and we're going to get right back to it with me, Michael Bolden, and Rob Nadelson, an important interview on the General Welfare Clause.
Now, talking about the health care, Dennis Kucinich, who's obviously a proponent of government-run programs, recently was trying to get some type of amendment to the health care proposal to, quote, allow states to run their own programs. What is his reasoning? I mean, obviously you're not in his head, but what would be the reasoning of going to the federal government to allow states? Is there some type of rule on the books that prevents them from doing their own at this point? Or
No, there isn't. And I have no way of knowing what is in Dennis Kucinich's head. I've not seen his proposal anyway. However, some people who are advocates of the welfare state give lip service to state powers. But they always think of state powers as a one-way ratchet. In other words, they want the federal government to do is to spend a certain amount of money, impose a certain amount of regulations, and then if states want to exceed that and spend even more money and impose even more regulations, well, that's okay. But almost invariably, those folks would not want the state to spend less money or impose fewer regulations. than the federal government would mandate. So it's sometimes those sorts of programs are a way of trying to get even bigger government by allowing the states to add on to the federal program.
I've often seen the argument, going back to the original meaning of the General Welfare Clause, that there's an implied power to spend because there's an ability to tax. That's pretty straightforward and clear. They obviously have to do something with that money. How do you address that that type of reasoning?
Well, that was the holding of the Butler case I mentioned a few minutes ago, that or the position of the Supreme Court starting in 1936, which was that the that power to tax also gave an implied power to spend. And to explain why that's wrong, first I need to say something about where the spending power of the federal government really comes from. And secondly, I need to say something about the wording of the General Welfare Clause. Almost every power that the federal government has carries with it a certain power to spend. So, for example, the federal government has the power to raise and support armies. Well, that carries with it a power to spend money to pay the troops, to buy the weapons, to buy the ammunition. The federal government has the power to regulate commerce. Well, that carries with it the power to spend the money to hire the regulators and to pay them. The Congress has the power to tax. That means the Congress has the power to pay revenue officers, to pay tax collectors. We may not like the Internal Revenue Service, but it is constitutional. They may do too much, but it's constitutional for the Congress to set up an Internal Revenue Service. So each one of these powers carries with it an associated power to spend. The modern Supreme Court, however, takes the position that the taxing power also gives a power to spend that goes beyond any of those other powers. You can spend on anything you wish. And that's kind of an odd conclusion, because the General Welfare Clause, or the taxing clause itself, says nothing at all about spending. What it says is that Congress has the power to tax to provide for the common defense and general welfare. Now, this next point is important. When you read the Constitution, you have to remember that the Constitution is written in 18th century English. And while for the most part it's easy for a 21st century reader to read, once in a while you come across a phrase or a word in the Constitution that actually has a somewhat different meaning in the Constitution than it would have in modern discourse. So when the Constitution says the Congress has the power to tax to provide for the common defense and general welfare, that doesn't mean, like it might mean today, Congress has the power to tax and to spend for the common defense and general welfare. In 18th century English, that language, that word, the phrase to provide for has a future sense. It means Congress has the power to tax in order to store up provisions for, in other words, to store up money, to fill the treasury for, not to spend, but to fill up the treasury. The spending power comes from the other powers. In other words, as I said, the power to regulate commerce includes the power to spend money on officers who do the regulating, the power to raise and support armies implies the power to spend money for the purposes of the army. So the General Welfare Clause itself does not authorize spending. It's an example of a very common mistake that even professional constitutional scholars sometimes make. They're often unaware that seemingly innocent words in the Constitution had a specialized or different meaning than they have today.
And that view that you're talking about of the General Welfare Clause, that was primarily the view of James Madison in the Federalist Papers. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, sure. It was the view of James Madison. It was the view of everyone who wrote on the subject and who advocated the adoption of the Constitution. Their view was that all the General Welfare Clause does is limit the power to tax. There was never any suggestion during the ratification debate. Let me say there is an ambiguous reference during the Massachusetts ratifying convention. It's ambiguous. But other than that, there is no suggestion anywhere in the ratification debate from the advocates of the Constitution that the General Welfare Clause gave a power to spend. I mean, it just isn't there. As I mentioned, some people cite Alexander Hamilton, but Alexander Hamilton's claim that the General Welfare Clause brought about a power to spend wasn't made until several years after the Constitution was ratified, and he was Secretary of the Treasury, and he was trying to expand the federal government beyond its constitutional limits.
So let's say that obviously you'll say, but that your argument is correct, that the federal government is exercising powers beyond what it's authorized. Proponents of the expanded power will often say, well, yeah, so, but this is better. What's the argument in favor of the limited version of government under the General Welfare Clause, even if you weren't correct?
Well, the argument is, number one, if you followed the General Welfare Clause, we would be a freer people. We'd be a people with a more manageable government, a more efficient government. And as a practical matter, if you want to measure things in dollars and cents, we'd all, or at least most of us, would have a lot more money. We'd have a lot higher standard of living. We probably would have a longer health life expectancy. We probably would be healthier. We'd be able to afford health care and food and other things much more readily than we can today. We could leave more money to our kids and better secure their lives. And the environment would probably be better, because there's a close connection between the quality of environment and the wealth of the people. Wealthier people can afford more environmental amenities. So what that means is that by virtually every aspect of human welfare, we would be better off if the Constitution were being followed in this area. It would be a matter of, and of course, you have no way of quantifying it, but I would not be surprised at all if the average person under a system where the Constitution was honored had 50 to 100% more wealth and income than they have today.
I think that really is the great bottom line, that no matter what you believe, the most important thing, and probably why the founders and ratifiers created the system of government we have today, is to provide a better life for all of us.
That's right. That's right. It's the general welfare. There have been a lot of empirical studies comparing high tax states with low tax states, high tax countries with low tax countries, and the results are striking. I mean, a state that taxes more of its citizens' income away generally tends to be poorer than states that have lower taxes. And this also generally holds for countries. Countries that have bigger governments tend to retard their economic growth. Some folks talk about, for example, the fact that Ireland is a very prosperous country today. Well, one reason is because Ireland made the decision to restrain their government, which was just eating up their private sector. So when you take a look at those studies and you say, gee, what would it be like if we didn't have all this wasteful special interest spending in Washington, if we weren't trying to run programs from Washington at five times the cost that it would take to run them from the state capital or from the local county seat, what would be the possibilities? One thing I didn't mention, Michael, is that we'd have a better life in many ways. We'd have more money. We'd have more health and so forth. We'd probably also be much more technologically advanced. The 19th century in America was a time of very limited government. Obviously, we had government for certain important purposes, but it was a time of very limited government. And not surprisingly, it was also the time probably of the greatest technological economic advance in the history of mankind. So they are connected.
I think that sums it up better than just about anything out there. We just have another minute or so to go here. But why don't you tell our listeners a little bit of what you've been working on? Where can they find your writings? Obviously, over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com. What projects do you have going right now?
Well, you can find my writings at my faculty webpage at the University of Montana. And what you do is you enter into Google or another search engine, Nadelson or Robert Nadelson. Nadelson spelled N-A-T-E-L-S-O-N. And then you write University of Montana. And you'll probably my webpage will pop up. And you'll see that links are on the webpage to most of my major works in the constitutional area. So you can actually download PDF files of most of my major articles.
TRX. You're helping you to unlearn what they told you at government school. For more information on topics being discussed on today's show, visit us at radio.10thAmendmentCenter.com. That's radio.10thAmendmentCenter.com.
I know we're ending the show a little bit early tonight, and unfortunately, we don't really have the ability to take live calls on an interview that was recorded a while back. But I do hope that you were able to get something really good, something educational, out of this interview that I did with Rob. And I'm glad that we have this opportunity to share it once again, because I don't think too many people were able to hear it the first time around. And this format is giving us the opportunity to get it out to more listeners. So if you do have specific questions on this and you want some follow-up, there's two ways that you can ask some additional questions. And hopefully we'll actually do an additional show on this that covers your questions and comments. And we'll probably get Rob to come on and chat about it in the very near future. I know scheduling is often not an easy thing, but we'll work on getting that put together. But if you want to ask some questions about the General Welfare Clause, or for that matter, for any subject, you can do this in two ways. One, if you're on our Facebook page, you just go to facebook.com/10thAmendmentCenter and just leave a post there, question for 10th or radio, and then leave your question, and we'll be reviewing this on a week-to-week basis. Then the other option is to go to our website, 10thAmendmentCenter.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a button, a black button that says feedback. Click that and leave a question. We have people leaving questions and interacting. This is our online community question and answer forum. You can leave anything from constitutional questions to suggestions, ideas, report problems with the website, whatever it may be. And leave that there, and we'll start collecting more and more of these questions to address on the show, and we'll also be adding a voicemail line too. So if you want to call in and leave questions, we'll be doing that as well. So you can do that anytime during the week in case you're not able to be with us live in the chat room as we broadcast on Wednesdays. But please do go ahead, leave your comments, feedback, questions, etc. on the website or on our Facebook page, and we'll start building those and putting together for a nice cohesive show package to do a follow-up and address this important issue even further in the future. Again, I want to thank everyone who makes the show happen every week, our sponsor, Banking with Life. That's bankingwithlife.com. John Michaels and Bryce Shanka in the studio doing production and booking. My co-hosts, my rambling, rotating, ragtag bunch of freedom fighters, from Phil Russo to Leslie Swan, John Bush, Robert Scott Bell even came in and joined us. And please tune in every week. Find us on iTunes. Just go to radio.10thAmendmentCenter.com for all the info on that. And we'll be back next week, Wednesday.
You have been listening to TRX. TRX is a service of the 10th Amendment Center. It's about sticking to the Constitution. Every issue, every time. No exceptions, no excuses. No excuses. Tune in every week for current events, news and information, interviews, and public opinion. The 10th Amendment Center is a national think tank that works to preserve and protect the principles of strictly limited government through information, education, and activism. The Tenth Amendment Center serves as a forum for the study and exploration of state and individual sovereignty issues, focusing primarily on the decentralization of federal power as required by the Constitution. Visit us on the web at tenthamendmentcenter.com. That's tenthamendmentcenter.com.